Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm going to talk about two things, really. One is what's been going on with the undercover police in England, and secondly, how it came to be exposed. So I'll talk for a little while, and then hopefully we could have a discussion afterwards. I want to begin the story, really, with a passport that was found in a van in Italy. And it was about late 2010, and there were two people on holiday in Italy. One was Lisa Jones. That's not her real name. She doesn't want to be her real name to be named, but she's known as Lisa Jones. And she was on holiday with someone she knew as Mark Stone. And they had been in a relationship for 6 years. It was a long relationship. And for about sort of the last 2 or 3 months, he had been acting a bit weirdly, and she didn't know why. But she was constantly torn between two positions. One was that, you know, Mark Stone was a man that she loved, or she thought she loved. And secondly, she feared that Mark Stone was not who he said he was. But every time she would sort of challenge him, he would come out with a story and she would sort of think, yeah, he probably is Mark Stone and he's not lying to me. Until they were on holiday in a camper van and he had gone out for a cycle, and she was looking through the glove in the compartment of the van and came across a passport. And in the passport was, the name in the passport was Mark Kennedy. And it was his picture. And she thought, that's a bit odd. But in a way, she didn't think it was that odd because, you know, sometimes people have fake names and for all sorts of reasons. But the thing, when she leafed through the passport, she came across the back of the passport. It said, you know, children. And it said he had two kids. And this is the first time that she ever knew about this. This is someone she had been in a relationship with for 6 years, and she had no idea that he had got two kids. And it said his name was Mark Kennedy, and it gave the name of the kids and also the mother's name as well. And she was absolutely polaxed by this. And when he came back, she questioned him about, you know, what is this about? And he came out with some story that essentially was bullshit. But it was enough to really, you know, placate her and to think, perhaps he, you know, he really is Mark Stone and he's, you know, he hasn't made up his life. When they came back from holiday, she thought it was always difficult for her because on the one hand, you know, this is someone that she had been in a relationship with for 6 years, she wanted to love him, she wanted to trust him, but on the other hand, you know, she really thought that there was something wrong about him. And one day she, just on impulse really, checked out the birth certificates of the kids of the Mark Kennedy. And to cut a long story short, it came back to show that he was a police officer. And that completely devastated her. She'd been in a relationship with a police officer who's an undercover police officer for 6 years, and this is the first time she ever knew about it. She confronted him with a group of friends. He had been active in an environmental group, in the anarchist groups, for, you know, 7 years, as she had as well. And she didn't quite know what to do in this situation, but she thought, well, I've got to confront him, I've got to find the truth. And with a group of other activists, they confronted him, and he actually sort of broke down and admitted that he had been an undercover officer. And this was the first time. Really, I think that what happened, why this is key, is that it's produced a sea change in people's perceptions of what the police were doing, and especially about how far the police were prepared to go in terms of infiltrating and spying on activists. And I think before this happened in about 2010, I think a lot of people like myself sort of thought that the police would send, you know, they would send officers along to meetings like this, you know, and they'd sort of take notes and then go back to their job the next day in the police station. But what this showed was that the police were prepared to take an officer, give that officer a fake identity, and deploy that officer to go and live the life of an activist virtually full time for like 6 or 7 years. And that changed a lot of people's perception, and I think opened people's eyes in Britain that, my God, this is, you know, this is how far the police had been prepared to go. But what's interesting is that actually the police, what Mark Kennedy, what the exposure of Mark Kennedy showed was, for the first time, the police, it exposed actually a police operation that had been running for 40 years. So for 40 years in Britain, the police had been sending undercover officers into political groups since 1968. And 1968, we know, is a year when, you know, there's a lot of political unrest right across Europe. And in Britain, the police came up with a very novel idea. Frankly, if you read the papers, what it showed, the official documents, what it shows is that the police and the establishment were a bit scared, really, that the, you know, activists, the left was getting growing in power and was, it could, you know, overthrow the established order. And what they needed were police, was better intelligence. What they had up to then were informants, people who were already in political groups, who could be blackmailed, persuaded, whatever, you know, compelled, or, you know, sometimes just by asking them to give information about the group they were in. But the problem for the police is that informants are notoriously unreliable, and they can never quite be certain that an informant is telling the truth. So what they wanted was to have a police officer who they think is a trained observer and a much better sort of observer and gatherer of intelligence. They wanted to insert them right into the centre of political groups. So in 1968, they came up with this idea of creating fake activists. And this is where they created quite an elaborate plan. And they would take a police officer, they would take their badge away from them, they would never go to the police station, and they would be given a new identity with fake papers, fake driving license. They would come up with a new name. Often what they do is that, like Mark Stone, they always keep the first name of the fake name, their own name, because it's very difficult. If you're known as Mark and you take the fake name of, I don't know, Bob, you don't react to it as quickly as if someone calls you Mark. So they would always, what they did was create a fake name with their real name, but a fake second name. And again, this was, all of this, the police over time used a lot of sort of thought about what they were doing. And what they did, even with the second name, was what they wanted was a name that was sort of, you know, I don't know if this will translate, but if I took the name of, you know, John Smith, then that's very obvious. That's a very obvious sort of British name. You know, people use that name notoriously to sort of check into hotels when they're having an affair. So what they needed was a name that's sort of not too obviously fake, but not so well known that people would remember them. So they would take the fake name, and then the state, the police, would issue that activist with all the relevant documents that they needed in that fake identity, like your driving license, your tax, sometimes even a police record, all these sort of in the databases of the state. And then they would send these people off to go to join political groups, live in their own flats, live the life of activists for 7 days of the week. And what they wanted was to go and find out what was going on, report back about demonstrations they were planning, what protests they were doing, who were the key people in groups, what were they thinking, what did they want to do in the future, all of this stuff, and they would just constantly, every week, just be sending it back to their handlers. And we don't know how many undercover officers there have been in that 40 years, but we think it's in the region of around 150, which I think is a lot. And since then, we've actually been finding out more and more of what they've doing, what they've been doing. This has produced various sort of controversies about what they've been doing. The first one is the justification. Often they're actually being sent off to groups that are not really involved in heavy, you know, serious crime. What is the what is the justification for doing that? You're intruding into people's lives. Why are you doing that? Secondly, undercover officers frequently were having long-term relationships with women, people they had been sent to spy on. And these are not relationships like, you know, a one-night stand. These are very long, substantial relationships. There was one undercover officer who lived basically with a woman who never knew his real identity for 5 years. They were like a domesticated couple, man and wife. He would, in the morning, he would stay overnight. In the morning, he would have a fake job. They all had fake jobs to go to. He would say, goodbye, you know, I'm going off to my fake job. Actually, what he was doing was going back to his wife, his real wife, who was living in another part of London. And he did this for 4 or 5 years. Thirdly, we're also finding out that the undercover officers were spying on families who were grieving. They were in a dispute with the police because their relatives had died at the hands of the police, or most notoriously, there was a case, I don't know if you know about it, called there was a young black 18-year-old called Stephen Lawrence, and he was stabbed by a racist gang in 1993. The police basically, because of their racist attitudes, did not properly investigate his murder, and it produced a huge scandal in Britain. And recently it's transpired that instead of actually helping the family by finding out who had killed their son, they had been spying on them. Fourthly, we've also been finding out that the undercover officers have been acting as agents provocateurs, have been information that they have gathered in trials has not been disclosed. It's produced a number of unsafe convictions, miscarriages of justice. We've had 56 activists have had their convictions wiped, overturned, because the police had not disclosed at their trial, as they should have, the evidence gathered by undercover officers. So you've had, what's happened is that you've had undercover officers involved in those protests, but their involvement has not been disclosed, and that has corrupted the trial. What's also come out is that you've got undercover officers who have been travelling across Europe, really, to infiltrate activists in other countries. And most notoriously, actually, that we know about was Mark Kennedy. And Mark Kennedy was almost like an international spy. He was he was undercover for 7 years. And during that time, he went and spied. He went abroad to 11 countries and must have been gathering information on activists in those countries. He went to Iceland, he went to Spain. There was a long list of them. But also he came to Germany. And he quite regularly used to come to Germany. And he was hired, actually, by the German government, by the German police, to spy on German activists in Berlin and several other places. And he was involved in crime here twice, and that was just forgotten about, you know, ignored by the authorities, because they wanted to cover up the fact that he was an undercover officer. He was very active in various protests to do with the G8, And I think what's interesting, he was also active in the Black Bloc anarchists. And what's interesting is that actually behind the scenes, you get quite a lot of information, crossover, a pooling of exchange of information between the police forces in Europe and in the G8 protests in 2005, which were held in Scotland. You had Germany, the German police sent 5 undercover officers into the protests to spy on the protests to do with the G8. I'm raising this now because obviously we've got the G20 going on here. And sixthly, there's a whole series of controversies, but the last controversy I want to mention is that in Britain we had, unfortunately, big companies funding a blacklist of essentially, they wanted to keep a blacklist of workers who were deemed to be troublemakers or, you know, unsound, who would then be denied jobs in the construction industry. And what's come out apparently is that the police actually have been exchanging information with that blacklist in order to deny, to give information to the blacklist, which is then in turn being used to deny particular trade unions work. So all of this has sort of been, from that, the first incident, the first exposure of Mark Kennedy, we have in 2008, there's been a sort of cascade of revelations which has now forced the government to institute, to set up a public inquiry led by a judge, which will now look at all of the undercover operations going back to 1968. And it gives the people who are spied on a chance to find out what had happened to them. I think what's interesting about this is that how a large amount of information that's come up has actually come up from the activists. The people who are spied on have, in a sense, been turning the tables on the police, and they have been the ones who have come up with the clues and the detective work to unmask the undercover officers. And we know of those 150 officers undercover since 1968, we now know the identities of around 15 of them, with several and more who are sort of suspected but not yet. And I think what's interesting is that because we've had 15 undercover officers exposed, with the help actually of a police whistleblower, we had Peter Francis was an undercover officer who was sent off to infiltrate anti-racist groups for 4 years, and he said he came to the conclusion that he thought this was wrong and has come out to be a whistleblower. But from that you can actually fit together and try to work out what their tradecraft is. You know, tradecraft is a rather sort of grand word for how they operate, but you can see a pattern of how these undercover officers have operated. And from that, you can actually begin to work out, have a better idea who they are. And what tends to happen is that you have an undercover officer that usually they're deployed for about 5 years. So they turn up, they ingratiate themselves. Undercover officers are always very helpful. They're the ones who will say, they all drive, so they'll say, I'll carry the banners to wherever needs to be taken. They will always volunteer to help out. And then the first day that they arrive on the scene, they will be plotting their departure. Because they want to, after 4 or 5 years, lay down a plausible excuse or story of why they're going. So some of them will say, Peter Francis, for example, who was the whistleblower, talked about, early on in his deployment, he sort of set the idea that, he wanted to go travelling, he was a bit sort of unsettled, and what they don't want is suddenly to come up with, when they disappear, they don't want to suddenly disappear with people thinking, that's a bit odd, why is he gone? What they want to do is weave quite an intricate story. So Peter Francis, for example, talked about how he had wanderlust. He was a bit unsettled. He wanted to go travelling. then he sort of made up this story about how he was a school caretaker, how he had had a row with the school and had nicked the television and he had to go on the run. And he then sort of went across, he went and spent 6 months travelling in France and Spain and Greece. But during that time, what he was doing was sending back postcards saying, oh, I'm in Greece having a great time. He would phone up activists, oh, yeah, I'm here in Barcelona, I'm having a great time. And slowly, the contact would diminish. But there wouldn't be that abrupt, you know, he's gone, he's there one day, then he's gone. So it's quite an intricate, you know, what they call the exit strategy is quite, again, very thought out. A favourite one is that you have undercover officers who feign having a breakdown, they fake having a breakdown. So they'll start saying, oh, I've got to, you know, my head's all over the place, I've got to go abroad and get, you know, get myself together. And then they would go. And they've used that several times. So you can begin to see a pattern. And what's interesting is that you have undercover officers, the fake activists, they disappear after 5 years, and then they're never seen again. Which is sort of unusual for, I know activists, you know, sometimes you're active and then you're not, but often you will still see former activists around. But with an undercover officer, you just never see them again. So one way that people have found out the identities of undercover officers is that one of the tricks that the police came up with was to give people an identity, a fake identity, was that they would steal the identity of a dead child. So one of the first things that an undercover officer would do, they would join the unit, and then they would spend about 4 months going through the state archives trying to find a boy or a girl, but most of the undercover officers are men. So if my name is Rob, you'd be trying to find the identity, you'd be trying to find a boy who died with my name, Rob, about my age. And once you'd found it, you would then research that family. You would resurrect that, you would take that identity, resurrect it as your own, but then you needed to go and research the family and construct a plausible story. So if I came, for example, my name was Rob, I stole the identity of a boy who died in Bristol, which is a city in the UK, in such and such a day, you'd go to Bristol and you would, you know, look at the area and research the area, because what you don't want is to turn up in a group and some people say, oh, you're chatting away in the pub. Where are you from? Bristol. Oh, I was from Bristol. Do you know X pub? You know, and you don't know. So you've got to know, for example, the local landmarks. So again, this takes quite a long time. But the problem is that once activists and the public knew that that's what they were doing, they could go back and look at the lives of activists who they thought were undercover officers. And for example, there was one undercover officer called Rod Richardson who said, you know, because the fatal flaw in all of this is that if the police send someone to be an undercover officer into your life for 5 years, you actually learn quite a bit about them. So for example, Rod Richardson said he was born on a particular day in January 1973. And the activists remember, oh yeah, on that day, which he said was his birthday, we had a big party. So they knew which day he was pretending to be born. So they went back, the activists went back and had a look, you know, Rod Richardson, was he born on this particular day? Yes, he was, but he had died 2 days later. So he was a fake. So from these ways, you can work out who they are. And I'll give you another example of an undercover officer called John Dines, who had a relationship for 2 years with Helen Steele, an activist called Helen Steele. And so he had a relationship with Helen for 2 years. And then after 2 years, he needed to disappear. But he had to deceive Helen. Helen had no idea he was a police officer. So again, he went into this whole routine of, oh, I'm having a breakdown, you know, I'm very unsettled, I've got to go abroad. So he went off to, he said he was going to South Africa. But Helen actually was very tenacious, and she was worried about him. She thought she was still in love with him. She thought, she was worried that he may actually commit suicide. So she was, you know, making tremendous efforts to try and phone the British Embassy in South Africa. What's happened to her? Have you heard of this man? Looking through all the missing persons. And she sort of began to think there's something odd about this. He sent back a few letters saying, I'm fine, don't worry about me. And she actually went and checked one day in the records. John Dines was pretending to be a man. He had a fake name of John Barker. And she went and checked, you know, did John Barker exist? And she found that John Barker, born on the day he said he was born, had died. So again, she sort of, you know, began to piece together the clues that he was not actually who he said he was. I'm just going to finish with two other examples. Oh, sometimes you can find out who undercover officers are by their own mistakes, actually. Their own mistakes. There was a man called, purporting to be called Simon Wellings. And in 2000, he was active in anti-globalisation movement. And in 2005, he disappeared. He disappeared because of this reason. One day, one of the activists picked up their answer phone messages and thought he could hear a recording of the man he knew as Simon Wellings in what appeared to be a police station discussing individual activists and what they were doing and talking about this unit called CO11. And what had happened, it appears, is that Simon Wellings had been in the police station going through various photographs of activists, talking to his, you know, police mates, colleagues about them, but somehow pressed his own mobile phone and then made a record and called this guy who was out his answer phone. So it was recorded. But what's interesting about this is that in 2005, they confronted him, but, you know, he was spooked and he disappeared. But they never thought, they sort of thought he was a bit odd. But it was only actually, you know, 5 years later when Mark Kennedy came out that they actually thought he was an undercover officer. And true enough, he was actually. There was another man who was purporting to be called Carlo Nero. And Carlo was active in anti-racist groups, left-wing groups for about 5 years. He had three relationships with women, again, who never knew who his real identity was. And he, again, in about 2011, people started to go back. They were aware of undercover officers. They were now thinking who could have been an undercover officer. And they remembered this man, Carlo Nero. Carlo Nero turned up for about 5 years and then disappeared. You know, who was he, an undercover officer? People started looking at him. And what was interesting about this is that he'd had one relationship, another relationship, and then he had had another relationship with someone called Annie, and who was sort of, you know, not an activist, but on the periphery. And again, looking through all the directories, you could see her name with someone called Carlo with a different name, his real name, which is a very distinctive Italian name. And essentially, we could then track down, because he had such a distinctive Italian name, we could track down his real wife, his actual wife, who said, yes, he was a police officer. So he had made a fatal mistake by giving his real name in one of these directory inquiries. I don't know if you have it here, but you know, you have a list of all of the your phone numbers, your name, your phone number, and you look people up. And he had made a mistake there. So you could again piece it together and see who he was. Most recently, we've had the case of Andy Coles, who was an undercover officer in the 90s in animal rights groups under the name of Andy Davey. About 6 months ago, Andy Coles. So Andy Coles was someone who had gone undercover in the 90s. He had been undercover for about 4 years, animal rights groups, come out, retired from the police, and had gone on to be a police commissioner, which is quite a senior post in, not a massive, a deputy police commissioner, not a, sort of quite a senior post in Britain, but not massively. He happened to have quite a famous brother called Richard Coles, who was in the band, I'm looking at the older members of the audience here, called the Communards in the 80s. I won't sing it for you, but he was in the Communards. He had then gone on to be a vicar, and he had gone on to be a broadcaster. And he had written his autobiography. And in there were a few lines saying, oh, my brother, you know, was in the police, and he was undercover, you know, and he had got this fake identity, and he had got a sort of, grew a long shaggy beard. And from that, people could piece together who his real, what his real identity was. Because he'd got a public post there, you could see the photograph. And actually, when the photograph came out, someone who had had a relationship with him, been again another woman who had been deceived into a relationship, recognised him. And he was again exposed, all from that one small passage, about two or three lines in the book. You could go back and fit together what he had been doing. So I think the key thing is really activists who have been spied on are pooling information. You have a group called the Undercover Research Group who are, you know, who produce very detailed profiles of undercover officers, and they can fit together, you know, they can sort of piece together bits of information. And from that, slowly, the truth of what's been going on is coming to light. And I always look upon this as like being a sort of secret history, a secret slice of history in Britain that's been, the police have been running this secret operation since 1968. We don't know very much about it, but now we are actually, over quite a few years, beginning to slowly, you know, open the box and look inside and see what's been going on. And with that, I'd like to end.